Hello everyone, and a warm welcome back to Footprints. This month's episode is all about the community of growers and gardeners in and around Bath. We're not talking about traditional farming here, we're talking about market gardens, allotments, and taking care of small patches of land. Growing locally became very popular during the First and Second World Wars, but in the decades since, intensive farming practices have drowned out the small-scale grower. But in recent years, there's been a bit of a resurgence, and more people have been coming together to grow and share food, care for the land they live near or they live on, maybe in an effort to help communities tackle some of the challenges we're all facing. In this episode, I'll be finding out about forest gardening in Bath Easton, and I'll go bug hunting on the Whiteway Estate. But to start with, let's meet Hamish Evans. Back in 2020, during the pandemic, at the age of 22, Hamish co-founded Middle Ground Growers, a hugely successful veg box scheme, delivering boxes by bike. Hamish believes in small-scale growing, saying it makes sense on many levels. People get to eat healthy, seasonal, organic food, and economically, the money stays within the Bath community. And that way, people are supporting their local bakery, butcher, and fruit and veg growers. Since those early days, they've expanded and they're now on a new piece of land at Western Spring Farm. And I went to meet him there.
Yes, I'm Hamish Evans, co-founder of Middle Ground Growers. We're like a core team of four. And then we've also got a wider network of kind of trainees, volunteers, our veg box team as well. They're kind of a core part of this work. And so it's kind of a community-supported agriculture model. So we've got 120 members who sign up for their weekly box for the whole year, or like a summer season. And then we've got quite a few sort of restaurants, shops, cafes and Bath we supply as well. And we also work with other farms like Community Farm to kind of like supply for their veg boxes, etc. And we're here at Western Spring Farm, which is one of our sites and one of our growing places. And that's a sort of 15-acre ecological farm. Agroforestry, market garden, coppice, nuttery, etc. We've also got a few smaller market gardens dotted around Bath and hopefully kind of multiplying and pollinating more as our trainees this year sort of moving on to new plots as well. So we're looking to kind of just keep building and growing that, but at an appropriate scale, but also one that's kind of effective and actually, you know, supplies a good quantity of Bath food.
Just describe the view ahead for me, you know, what you've got here. Just paint the picture.
Yeah, so we're kind of looking onto like a fairly hilly landscape. We've got the Cotswolds area of natural beauty. You can just see Kelston Roundhill, those cluster of trees. We've got a nice little walk up there for sunset. And so in front of us, we've kind of got loads of wildflowers just on the entrance. And then just beyond that, we've got the market garden. So we've got all of the crops for our veg boxes. And then just beyond that, we've kind of got the agroforestry set up. So we've got like orchards, we've got rows of brassica crops and onions at the moment because we're getting into autumn. We've got a big field of squash at the top. So there's some big orange beasts lurking in the grass up there. It's like a restoration agriculture model. So it's kind of like fruit tree crops with an understory of berry bushes or something like that. Understory of wildflower strips, pollinators, and then we've got the veg crops. And then the pattern kind of repeats. And on the lower field, kind of to our right, a bit out of shot, that's where our spring water comes down. And we've got a small coppice down there, so willow and hazel. And that's also where the nuttery is as well.
So why have we gone down the intensive route over the last few decades?
Well, I think it's a mixture of reasons. It's a whole, I wouldn't say sort of blaming farmers helps anything. There's been wider economic forces of globalisation and stuff, which is talking to like neighbours and other growers around here that are much larger scale. They've been forced into a route to kind of almost like survival mode, you know, to make it work. And then they've been sort of sold this myth, both into kind of debt-driven agriculture, but also quite industrial scale. So there's this very like common culture, just like, you're like be able to profit more because you've got like more fertiliser, more inputs, more tractor, more acreage, more specialisation into, you know, one crop. And kind of things like land prices as well have shifted things. But I think there's a whole host of kind of quite complex global but also local problems that have kind of caused that shift.
Could we operate using your model and feed the nation? Is it scalable?
I think we need a mixture of models. I think we could use these kind of principles like principles and ethics we've borrowed from kind of permaculture, regenerative growing. There's this permaculture triad of kind of earth care, people care, and fair share. So it's kind of about, yeah, really putting them at the heart of what we do. And then there's this other sort of influencing factor for us has been regenerative agroecological growing. So that's about any form of growing that is actually like regenerating the land it's on rather than kind of depleting and degenerating it. And so I think if that can be applied both in different models and different scales, then I think it's a very viable way, because what we've already noticed here is actually, you know, things like yield and, you know, even like income and things like that are all actually increasing because it's regenerating every year. So our soil health is like phenomenal. We just walked past some cabbages that are bigger than our heads, you know. So without actually inputs of fertilizer and things, we're actually, our soil health and our things are improving, and we're sort of getting more like higher population of bird species, and we're getting more sort of insects and things that eat the pests, that eat the veg, and we're just getting these more like continuous loops. Yeah, you know, if that model can be kind of replicated in different contexts following a similar pattern of, like, you know, minimal tillage and things like that. We had one of them in every neighbourhood. We could easily provide all the fresh food needs. And then we sort of get on to the kind of more like, you know, the calories and the fats and things like that, which we can certainly do a lot of in this way. And we've got the nuttery. We're doing a lot more storage crops like squash and potatoes. But we're also interested to kind of look at a very mixed model. We don't need, like, there's not one perfect farm size in my view. It's like we need the really tiny little urban garden that's providing just like, you know, fresh salads and really nutrient dense things. And then we need kind of the outer zone stuff, the kind of mixed farms, things like that. And then I think we also need sort of look at new ways to do like our bulk grain crops and stuff like that. So that might be through, there's some interesting stuff going on with cereal crops and sort of looking at like agroforestry, growing grains between tree crops and doing it in a much less intensive way, like organic, no-till. So there's some really interesting things sort of moving in those spheres as well. We're focusing on the veg for now, but we'll certainly be, once our nut crops kick in and other sort of long-term staple crops, we'll be sort of expanding that over time.
We talked about scaling up, but I've just thought, could you scale this right down to a back garden size?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think the like forest gardening is kind of the garden level of what we're doing here. Forest garden mimics a natural forest, kind of have lots of like, you know, tall canopy trees like your walnuts, etc., oaks, and then you've got your lower kind of fruit trees and apple trees, pear trees, etc. And then you've got your kind of ground crawlers and vines, you know, imagine grapevines climbing up the trees. You've got your berry bushes in the understory. You've got your kind of annual veg crops and things like that. So it's trying to sort of mimic what we'd see in nature, basically, but then kind of tweaking it a bit to be like, oh, well, what's the exchange here? And what do we also need in terms of like medicinal plants, food plants, staple crops, etc.? So that we kind of got like a massive forest garden here. So that could definitely be applied to a small garden, yeah.
Now, you mentioned you're attracting more insects and they're eating the bugs. Are they eating enough of the bugs? Do you have a bug problem?
We're fairly new on this particular growing site. And this year's been really good, actually, in terms of kind of pest problems. You know, we don't view it in the typical way of kind of like pest problem and then solution spray or like this sort of thing. It's a much more, you have to take a bit more like a holistic approach to kind of grow organically and regeneratively. You've actually got to kind of step back and be like, okay, what sort of ecological system creates balance in populations, and then you'll have, you know, plant life and animal life will thrive. So, you know, it can take time to get to that, especially because we've got kind of imbalances in populations. We've killed off a lot of wild populations, insect populations have declined, partly through farming methods, industrial farming, but also partly through, you know, our other practices and pollution and waters, you know, full of chemicals and plastic and things. But yeah, there's a lot of factors that have sort of led to that. So we're in this state, we've got to, it can't just be like sustainable growing, we've got to actually regenerate it and make it better. Yeah, so the way we approach pest problems and things like that, we've got kind of got a mixture of methods, but we try to sort of aim for getting that balanced diversity. So we've got, you know, there's lots of things like bird boxes, wildflower strips, pollinator strips, you know, in the fields, we actually plant those underneath the orchard rows and things like that to try and attract much more diversity. The less we disturb the soil, the more soil life there is. So actually it's the stuff we don't see under the soil, which is crucial to that kind of pathogenic resilience and things like that. So it's kind of viewing the farm as an ecosystem rather than kind of farmer's production machine, really.
I'm beginning to understand it's a whole systems approach you're looking at. You're not seeing anything as the body. It's how everything lives together in balance so that you can make the most use of the land and grow enough food for a local community without depleting the soil, without overproducing. And this just needs replicating, I guess. And
Yeah, there's a recent event with Land Workers Alliance trainees, and there were like dozens of, you know, new growers that wanted to do things like in this similar way, but there's a huge mismatch between like that and like the access to land, the access to startup capital, and yet we've got these thousands of acre farms that are all kind of, you know, basically running on debt and subsidies, and yet we've got an economically viable model on a small scale. We've got 4 full-time people paid in a living wage on this site on a very small acreage. And then you look at all the fields around us and no one's ever on the fields, and it's kind of all debt driven. So we've got a very economic proposition as well as an ecological one. It's nonsense that there's like no demand, there's no like new growers wanting to do it. There's tons. They just need to be like matched up with the opportunities and kind of for people to be like open to that and open to them learning. So many of the solutions just like start with the soil and start with like the people here. And what we realize through this is that so many other people get involved, and we've got, you know, volunteer days and people coming from the community that get really, you know, sort of passionate about the local food, and they like connect to the soil more, which, you know, they don't have much access to. There's huge ripple effects that you can't quite, you know, explain, but yeah, the solutions are all like here. It doesn't need to be some far off big complex thing. It can be right here where we are.
Thanks to Hamish Evans there from Middle Ground Growers. If you want to find out more, just head to the programme notes for their social media links. Now, next up, I was invited to visit a small-scale forest garden project, which was also started during lockdown.
Now, I'm here at Bath Easton. I've come to see Emily Wright. She said, meet me in the forest garden, and you'll find the forest garden through the secret garden. So, I think this is the secret garden. It's a beautiful formal garden. A laden apple tree. Many trees, actually. One propped up. Lots of box hedging. Each of the 4 borders has got a little rose. Some verbena fading now at the end of summer. And behind this secret garden, I'm looking for the Grow Bath Easton Forest Garden. Let's walk up here. Are you Emily?
Yes.
Hi. Emily, take me to the forest garden.
Yeah, so this is the secret garden that's a community garden owned by the parish council. And this plot here behind the secret garden is the forest garden. So this, as of last year, was thoroughly overgrown. You know, it was basically the compost heap for the secret garden. So we had an idea that we've been looking for community planting areas for some time over the last couple of years. Thought, wow, we can turn this into a forest garden, because a few of us have been on permaculture courses, forest garden courses. Thought, this is just perfect.
So it sounds like a forest garden is a thing. What is a forest garden?
So a forest garden, it's sort of an extension of permaculture approach of working with the environment and the ecosystem that you've got. So a forest garden is basically an edible forest, and everything within the garden has a purpose, from the top layer, the top canopy of a tree that provides protection for animals, plants, right down to the microorganisms in the soil. And there's different layers. So the idea being is you can walk in here and everything has a benefit to you. It's either you can eat it, or you can have benefits from, say, medicinal, or you just benefit from your well-being. I mean, this is a space where actually it's just lovely to hang out. We do a couple of times a month, we do community planting to get rid of the bindweed that's everywhere. But it's just a lovely place to sort of sit and recuperate from the week.
It's lovely, isn't it? It's beautiful. Show me around then. Yes. Where should we go first? It's absolutely overrun at the moment with gorgeous flowering nasturtiums.
Yes, nasturtiums. If in doubt, plant a nasturtium to cover space. So the first thing we had to do for any forest garden was basically create a structure. So we put cardboard and wood chip down in certain areas. And then it's like, OK, we've got some beds to put in. What do we want to put in them? So we've got the nasturtiums, always popular squash. They climb everywhere, so it's a good place to put cover. And then a bit more structure. So we've already got some trees here. We unfortunately had to lose an elm because it had Dutch elm disease, but it's now been turned into a table and a bench. So
yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it? Look, yes. You can see the whole cross section of the elm. That's now the tabletop. That is absolutely beautiful.
I mean, one of the principles of forest gardening is you don't want to take anything out. It's got a purpose. So, yeah. And then what we've also put in is a lot of structure with new fruit trees. So we've got a nectarine here. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the nectarines on that. Maybe a few years older. We've got a fig tree here. We've got a mulberry over here. Now, this was somebody in our growers club said, I've got this mulberry. It's not working for me. Can you come and dig it up? Do you want it?
Where's the mulberry?
The mulberry is this great big stick over here. Now, we're a bit worried that we've done all the effort of digging up, but it's still showing signs that it's alive. So hopefully that will come back to life. We've got a medlar over here.
So that's pear, is it?
Well, no, it's a fruit of its own. I've never tasted it. You get them in specialist shops, but you can make medlar jam and things like that. We have got several pears, lots of apples, and then this border over here, if we come down to the main path, this is where we have our soft fruit. We've got gooseberries in here. We did put raspberries, they weren't particularly happy. Currants. Strawberries have been popular this year, so we put strawberries at the edge. So you sort of think that one's about to go ripe, and then someone's been along and had it.
Yes, I can imagine. So who's it for? I mean, who gardens here? Who can come here? Who's allowed in? Who can eat the produce?
Yes, well, this is a public space, so anybody can come here. Anybody can come and enjoy the space. Recently, we've put up this notice board, so you actually know what this is about. Because most people understand the conventional gardening of the secret garden, but as you say, what's a forest garden? So we've got some information. So anyone can come and enjoy the space, and anyone can come and enjoy the produce. I think that's one of the first things I noticed, because last year we planted 40 fruit trees across the village. And I noticed someone picking an apple the other day. I went, oh, you're picking one of our apples. And I went, no, Emily, it's a community tree. So you have to kind of get over that.
So what you're saying is I am allowed to take that pumpkin away.
Yes, if it's ripe. I think there's a courgette that might have been thought it was a pumpkin that's outgrown its face.
But there must be a lot of people involved in gardening here. How many have you got at the moment?
So we have a very popular growers club and we have a community planting club. So if people are free on a Saturday morning, so we run regular groups on a second Saturday of the month and last Sunday of the month. And we just say, we're meeting down here, come and join us, bring your secateurs and your gardening gloves. And it's just nice to chat as well as, you know, clear weeds and plant things. So anybody in the village who wants to come can come. It's on our website.
And you mentioned a growers club, and I've read recently that allotments and growing are sort of going through a resurgence at the moment. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we started Grow Bath Eastern 2 years ago in the middle of the pandemic. You know, a lot of us hadn't met each other. It started with an idea of someone saying, I've got an idea about getting people growing their own food. And what I've seen in the growers club is a community grow, not just plants. And so people are using the space, whether it's in their gardens, in somebody else's garden. I know one of our growers club is, you know, working the land in their neighbour's garden because they don't use it. So I think there's definitely been a resurgence of the joy of growing things.
One of the gifts of the pandemic was people growing more food, wasn't it? I certainly grew food in my garden.
Yeah. And also you're building confidence. We have plant swaps just in the car park, usually about 3 or 4 times a year. And people come down and bring their surplus. I've got too many tomatoes, or has anyone got any cucumbers? And you see, you know, confidence in growing. You know, people say, well, that usually dies on me. It's like, well, if you don't grow anything, nothing will die either.
Yes.
So, you know, it's sharing experiences and what's popular and you know, having a reason to talk to your neighbours. You know, one of the side effects of the pandemic was isolation, I think, and people not being able to get out there and be in space. We saw this space being used so much more during, you know, when we only had an hour out a day. And, you know, I've lived in Bath Eastern for 15 years. In the last 2 years, I've met more people than I ever did in the 13 years previous, because I have a reason to chat to them. How's your tomato plants growing?
And you're the chair of Grow Bath Eastern. Do you collaborate with any other groups that are around the city? I suppose I'm just trying to get a picture of what's around. You're obviously literally flourishing here, but there must be more groups like
so
you.
Many. One of our first meetings was actually listening to Claire from Blooming White Way and what they're doing up there. So we have a connection with them. We also have a really good relationship with Bathscape, so they've helped us. You'll see on our notice board we've got from Bathscape what wildlife is available here board. So we've been working with Bathscape. They've donated seeds to help with our meadows. Since the National Trust took over the meadows, we've been working with them in terms of how can we connect these spaces.
So, Emily, people living in Bath Eastern might want to get involved, might not have heard about you. All they have to do is come down to the car park, turn right, walk through the secret garden, and here they are at the notice board.
Yes.
And they can find you on Facebook?
We are on Facebook. We are on Instagram. We also have a website, growbatheastern.co.uk, so people can email our community connector, Ali, and get involved. We've got pop-up markets running this year, thanks to BWCE funding, Bath and West Community Energy. So we've put the funding now towards pop-up markets and having local growers, local veg stalls, etc., and also to all the planting in the forest garden.
Thanks so much to Emily Wright for showing me around. This year, they're organising pop-up markets, and you can find out more by visiting their website, growbatheastern.co.uk, and they're also on Facebook and Instagram. Now, we all need a bit of inspiration when it comes to our front gardens, I think. Claire Loder and Jude Rice started Blooming White Way in 2017 with their first and now annual Front Gardens Festival. These festivals are there to inspire us to turn our driveway gardens into wildlife havens, to fill our patio pots with plants for pollinators, and to create luscious edible beds. As they say, anything goes. So, back in May, I went to the heart of the White Way estate to meet the people involved and find out more.
So we're in White Way Green and we're in an area of the park that's really tucked away. It's called the Peace Path. And our last bug hotel was vandalised, unfortunately, so we're building back better. So we're building a much more official bug hotel and stuffing it with anything we can find that's kind of organic and little nooks and crannies for lots of different invertebrates to hide in and hibernate in and all sorts. And we got a really good turnout. I'm so excited.
Well, here we are at the bug hotel. That is amazing. It's got a proper roof.
On a pitched roof. Look at that.
We're cutting up sticks for the bug hotel. So I think this will just get stuffed in areas so that the bugs can make their home in it.
So with Jude Rice, I started Blooming White Way about 5 years, yes, our fifth year actually. And from that, we started a front garden festival. And from that, I guess as we've learned about the role of gardens, how they're connected to green spaces, and as we've understood how wildlife has declined and biodiversity is kind of diminished, we're thinking increasingly about the importance of our green spaces and the mosaic. And this park lends itself really well. I think it's like the beating heart of White Way, because it's like the green heart is at the centre of the estate and it kind of emanates out. So everything that happens here kind of emanates out through the gardens, through Haycombe Drive, that kind of squash circle, and then out to the landscape at English Coombe, the countryside that I can see across there, and then down through the city farm to Bath. So it's a really important site. I think it's really crucial. And a lot of people talk about how this space is kind of is vandalised, but I kind of think that, I mean, that's the human element. There, some of that goes on, but if you look beyond that and look at the wildlife and the potential for growing the biodiversity and all of the implications on well-being and, you know, all the stuff that we've learned over COVID and how good all that is for us, then I think it's a really exciting space. What's really lovely is we have a great network of hedges. There's a lot of old privet hedges from when it was a council estate. It's great for wildlife. So we've got great populations of starlings and sparrows. I've seen a sparrowhawk hunt along our street, you know, more than once. I saw it the other day. There's kestrels, there's buzzards and... I think a lot of people have been really up for this, and what we really wanted to do was not necessarily encourage people to garden more, but maybe to leave stuff. Because there are a lot of wild gardens. Some people might call them scruffy, but we're very excited by the bramble and the honeysuckle and the thick hedges, because that's abundant. So actually what we do is we take plants round, put little flags in them saying, we love your garden, join our festival. We started as Front Garden Festival, but we also collaborate with More Trees Baines. So we look after one of their community tree nurseries on Rush Hill, and we're there every week tending to those seedlings and trees. And the idea of that project is that we gather tree seeds locally, they're germinated in the city, and then they go out to tree nurseries across Baines with the idea that they go back into the ground. So it's this provenance, this local provenance, because we all know we need to plant more trees, but where are those trees coming from?
We're under a tree. Lucy, what are we doing under a tree?
We're just about to put a sheet underneath it, and then we're going to shake the tree.
This is an oak tree.
I'm not sure it is. I think it might be a sycamore tree. If it was an oak tree, lots and lots of other things would fall out of it as well. So now we're going to give the tree a good old shake. Don't shake the sheet. Keep the sheet still. Otherwise, everything will disappear.
See
anything moving? Oh, yeah, there's a little beetle there. Look. What else have we got? Big green aphid. Another beetle. Another little beetle. In fact, there's loads and loads of very small beetles and not very many spiders.
So it's a tree that beetles love.
It is. Because an oak tree will support about 2,000 different species. Sycamores less than that, but still loads and loads and loads of things living on it. Right, so should we get some of these beetles into the pot and then you can have a look at them through the magnifying glass? Oh, look, there's one. Yep. Oh, there's something in there. That was...
But we need that. Oh, no, it's flown off.
There we are. There's a couple. I like the look of that one because that's got a white stripe down its back. Oh, let's get those in as well. So what we're doing is then putting them in a little pot that's got a magnifying lid on it.
We won't need that then.
We'll just put the lid on. So then you can just have a look at them.
Look, lots fell out.
Ooh,
oh,
yeah. And that's going to turn into a ladybird.
Oh, yeah.
That's a baby ladybird. But this is a little weevil. See how beautiful and green it is? Don't stand ahead of. There it is.
Hi, I'm Rachel Spence and I'm a community worker on the White Way Estate, so I get involved in lots of community-based things. I'm paid for by the local church to live and work on this estate.
Fabulous. And how long have you been doing that?
I've been here about 3 years and I've got another 2 years of my current contract. So yeah, I'm just around. I'm involved in all kinds of community things and I love being with people and chatting to people.
So have you seen things change, particularly here, in the last year that you've been working here?
Yeah, sure. So when I first came here, I met with a colleague in this part of the park, and she said, let's create a path somewhere. And we'd looked all around the park, and I was like, yes, let's do it in the main bit over there. And then we walked to this bit here, and it was full of broken televisions and mattresses and litter and glass, and she said, I think this is the place that we need to do it. And I was like, oh no, this is like, no one will ever come here, it's too far hidden away and it's just all full of rubbish. But she and I worked together to clear all of that rubbish, and then we had this vision that we would create something like a path through the trees and the bracken. So we cut back some of the bracken and made something that we call the Peace Path, which is in this patch that we're working in today. And it literally makes my heart just sing, seeing all these people that are here identifying bugs and rebuilding the bug house, that they're all in this patch that we've really loved this patch of of the park for a few years.
That's amazing. And it strikes me that this is the heart of the community, isn't it? Do you feel that the community is involved in what goes on here?
I think that's growing. I think to begin with, they felt like there was no hope. So when I first moved here, people said, oh, that park, it's just a bad place. And it looked broken. Lots of different parts of it just looked broken and unloved. But since we've had park life up and running, and since we've had the Peace Path up and running, we also do something called Muddy Church, and we often hold that in this part of the park. And since then, I feel like there's more hope. And today, it's really, really just gives a load of hope. All these people loving this part of our park. And so I do think the community are involved, yeah.
It is absolutely full of people and children, isn't it, today?
It's just great. We have worked hard on social media, getting the word out there about park life and drawing people together. And for every one person that comes, if next time they bring a friend, then it will grow more and we'll have more people here. And it's great seeing people take responsibility for loving the park.
Well, once you start to love something and care about it, you want it to thrive, don't you?
Really like to see the estate of White Way thrive. It's had a bad name in the past, but there are so many people that are saying, right, now's the time to make White Way really have its place on the Bath map. And there are lots and lots of amazing community groups in this area, really rooting for the community, and the community themselves beginning to take that responsibility. And that's what we want.
My thanks go to Claire Loder, Lucy Bartlett and Rachel Spence, all actively involved in organising a wonderful day around the Peace Path in Whiteway. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you for joining me, and don't forget you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. Footprints is available on all your favourite podcast platforms, so please do like, subscribe, and of course share with your friends, family and colleagues. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.